We got our weekly wrap, we got the equal time law, we've got diversity in Silicon Valley, and we've got Krispy Kreme donuts. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here, everybody. It is finally Friday, the 23rd day of October. This one is. There was a whole lot of politics in the American economy this week, which is why our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond should probably more accurately be called today the weekly wrap of Inside the Beltway. Here to do that with us are Neela Richardson from Redfin, Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. They are both in our Washington bureau. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Neela, we're going to start with you. The topic, the first topic today is Paul Ryan, soon to be, I imagine, the Speaker of the House. The question is that going to change economic policymaking in Washington as we know it?
If one man could change economic policymaking or one woman, we would be a vastly different country right now. As well respected as Paul Ryan is, and he is respected because on both sides of the aisle because he brings not so much style but substance, and substance is sorely needed in Washington. The fact is there's still too many conflicting interests for him to push forward an agenda easily.
But Sudeep, we were promised that Paul Ryan was going to be different, that he was the man, that he was going to, you know, he's got endorsements and everything.
He was the savior to everyone's problems. Paul Ryan cannot fix a divided GOP, even though they have such a huge majority in the House. They are broken into factions, and he cannot fix that. Paul Ryan cannot change the fact that we are now 54 weeks away from a presidential election, and nothing else is going to get attention other than that. So he is, in the longer run, he actually could provide some benefit to the party, to the House, to a broken Congress. He's obviously far more interested in details of policy than your average politician, even though that's not saying much. but so that can make a difference in the long run, but it's not going to make any difference right now.
So, Neela, let me approach a deadline slightly closer to home in the hopes that it concentrates the mind. Forget 54 weeks of the presidential election we have, and I'm counting on a calendar here in my studio. We've got 7, 8, 9, 10, we've got 11 days till the debt limit ceiling is reached. The Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, says we're going to run out of money. So Ryan's going to be a chosen speaker like in a week. He's going to have 4 or 5 days to fix that. Is he going to be able to do it?
That's a great question. I really don't know the answer to that. Nancy Pelosi called it the calendar of chaos, and I agree with her.
That's a good one.
And we've done this every 2 years for a very long time, and I think we're going to have the same conversation next year. At some point, we have to stop hating the players and hate the game. We are the only advanced country that first spends money and then decides whether or not we're going to pay for it.
Right.
And that is going to be a recurring theme unless the process is fixed.
It is insanity. Sudeep, let me ask you, though, there are some substantive things already happening because of the looming debt limit, right? The Treasury Department canceled a sale of 2-year notes. The yield on 1-year treasuries is higher than the yield on slightly longer terms because people are uncertain as to what the American debt situation is going to be. It's already actually happening.
It is actually happening. There is at least some short-term damage that is occurring, and there's very little benefit that we get out of having this fight. And you'd think that the members who are pushing this in Congress would learn that they're not getting anything out of it. They're going to go through the same internal torture that they've been going through, and in the end, they're probably just going to pass a clean debt limit increase at the last minute. But this is a real problem. Because they always do.
Yeah.
But the Treasury Secretary is talking a lot more about the risk of an accident, something happening when you're this close to the line, and it could happen.
Oops. All right. Very quickly, we have a minute left. And in that minute, I want to talk interest rates. Neela, I want to talk the Chinese government has cut its interest rates. The European central government says it's holding steady on interest rates and supplying more stimulus. And yet here we are in this country talking about the Federal Reserve raising interest rates. You have your slice of the time left is 20 seconds. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah. Basically, the world is slowing and weakening. And right now, the greatest threat to the U.S. growth process is Congress. And so, yes, it's going to take a few days to figure it all out. This is the worst time for Congress to be putting at risk American interest rates and the strength of the dollar.
Right. What Ben Bernanke used to call muttering under his breath fiscal policymakers. Sudeep, slightly different question to you. I was talking to Felix last week on this segment about this. Has the Fed missed its window to raise rates?
It very well may have when you look at the rest of the world and see China desperately trying to lower interest rates and not knowing at all how far further it needs to go. When you see Europe, the European Central Bank saying that they have a lot further to go in stimulating their economy, that is not a good environment to start raising interest rates, and the Fed knows it.
All tech all the time on Wall Street today. Sudeep Reddy and Neela Richardson at Redfin and the Wall Street Journal. Vice versa, I guess you ought to say, in Washington. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you soon. Details, as I said, about all that tech business on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Given that right at the very tippy top of our collective list of economic things to worry about in this country is jobs, a moment now for the work we do and how we define it. There was a study out from the Pew Research Center this week that showed the number of Americans identifying themselves as self-employed is falling. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains that statistic and what it means.
Pew used the latest census numbers for the study, and it's not that this data is wrong, it's just incomplete. Or maybe the census just isn't asking the right questions. Rakesh Kocher wrote the Pew study.
Since it's a self-identification, some may say they are self-employed, some may say not. So how you identify yourself would probably require an additional set of questions.
Questions that the Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't ask yet, and maybe should be, says Susan Horseman with the Upjohn Institute.
The current population survey is trying to pick up what is your main job, and then it'll also pick up a second job. So to the degree that people are picking up side jobs, they may well not report that.
One of the problems is that this survey doesn't pick up people who are self-employed and have incorporated as a one-person business. What it asks is, are you unincorporated self-employed? And then there's
people who are working sort of part-time on things that they may not in their minds consider a job.
Arun Sundararajan is a business professor at NYU. He says those are your Airbnb folks and Lyft drivers. Susan Horseman says it seems that the number of people working gigs to piece together an income is probably growing. There just isn't enough current data to make that claim scientific.
A big part of the problem is just funding for statistical agencies to keep up with new trends in employment and business practices.
If the data comes out and the gig economy is indeed growing, the government's probably got to rethink social safety nets and benefits, like how to get health insurance and qualify for workers' comp. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Hey, don't look now, but the National Football League is innovating. If you're hoping to watch the Bills-Jaguar game this Sunday and you don't live in Buffalo or Jacksonville, flip on your computer instead of your TV. Yahoo is going to be streaming the game, and that will be the only place to see it outside those two cities. Yahoo says it's lined up more than 30 major advertisers, and yes, exclusive streaming of an NFL game is a noteworthy first, but do ad rates for football online compare to a typical Sunday game on the TV? Marketplace's Sally Herships kicks this one off.
Showing an NFL game at 9:30 on a Sunday morning from London, only online, is kind of an experiment, which is why the cost for a 30-second ad during the game...
It's very low.
Reportedly only about $50,000. Michael Leeds is a sports economist at Temple University. He says the same ad during Sunday afternoon football on TV could cost 14 times as much.
So this is cheap. Very, very cheap.
But Leeds says there's another reason advertisers may be excited about Sunday's game. They want to know what kind of fan will be watching.
Are the type of people who watch streaming different from the people who would watch over-the-air or cable broadcasts?
Maybe they're a little more techie than typical football fans.
Maybe people who watch streamed broadcasts aren't that interested in pickup trucks.
Which Leeds says means games online may attract different kinds of advertisers. Yahoo says it's bagged big brand names for Sunday. American Express, Snickers, and Chrysler. Joe Favorito is a sports marketing consultant. He says the world of broadcast sports is keeping its eye on this weekend's game. But there's just one thing Yahoo is after.
Brand names to come in and activate
and promote and be part of the experience versus trying to get a dollar out of it this time.
Yahoo reportedly paid $20 million for streaming rights. But even if ad prices online are less than for TV, Favorito says Yahoo could still consider Sunday a win, nabbing major advertisers for the first exclusive streamed football game. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Big tech news of the week were the BAFO earnings from companies that do what has come to be called cloud computing, data storage, basically, but at a ginormous scale. A big chunk of the cloud, it turns out, is in Texas. Dallas-Fort Worth is one of the country's top three markets for data centers. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman got a look inside the growing cloud.
If you've ever wondered where your data is stored, maybe those family vacation photos, your medical records, podcasts, or that fantasy football trade you made, it could all be here.
It requires a badge access and also a fingerprint scan.
In a highly secure gray building on a 70-acre campus north of Dallas, deep in the endless rows of computer servers stacked behind fenced-in cages. It looks a little like a prison, except...
You know, there's not a lot of people here, so it's mainly for running computers.
Brian Marsh is vice president of Digital Realty. It's a global company that sells real estate for data. His clients couldn't care less about lush amenities like private conference rooms or gyms. What they want is security, electricity, and space. Marsh won't say who these clients are. Top industries include banking, healthcare, retail, and it'd be difficult to figure out. There's even a large white curtain concealing some computer servers. One thing he does reveal, business is good.
You know, demand keeps growing and exploding, and it's almost tough to keep up with it at times.
Demand is growing because of us.
You and I use a data center every day when we use our phones, when we use an app to order something, when we trade, when we look at an insurance, when we bank. When you play a game, every time you're hitting a data center.
Bo Bond is the local director for the Chicago-based real estate firm JLL. Its research shows North Texas is the number three data center market in the country right now. Northern Virginia and Northern California take the top two spots, which makes sense since they're government and tech centers. So why North Texas?
When you get to Dallas, we're very diverse on our industries, and we have a very low cost of power. Low taxation, centrally located, great airport, easy to develop.
Those ingredients have lured third-party data centers like Digital Realty and major companies. In July, Facebook started building a $1 billion data center in Fort Worth, not far from a center owned by Blue Cross Blue Shield and another for Citigroup. Bond says states and cities are actually fighting to recruit data centers because, dull as they sometimes are, they can be a gold mine.
First off, the amount of investment is much greater than any other piece of real estate, much more than an office building, a warehouse, a retail, a hotel. And to a municipality, that's tax revenue, right?
And there's one more thing.
It doesn't really tax your infrastructure. It doesn't necessarily put another kid in the schools.
Because a data center doesn't employ a lot of people. Still, nearly two dozen states have specially tailored incentives to attract these types of server farms, according to the Associated Press. Pierre Delforge with the Natural Resources Defense Council says the biggest data center drawback is energy use.
We don't build new smelters or steel plants anymore, but these are the modern equivalent of these industrial large energy users.
In 2013, the Defense Council reported that data centers in the U.S. used around 90 billion kilowatt hours of electricity. That's the equivalent of 30 large power plants. But he adds, the big corporate data centers are getting better with energy efficiency. He calls the millions of small server rooms in offices across the country the vampires in the closet and says they're the most wasteful. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
coming up.
Girls used to be 35% of computer science majors in college, and now women are 18%. So we're going in the wrong direction.
Turning things around in Silicon Valley. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 157 points this Friday, 0.9%, closed at 17,646. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ, up 111 points, 2.2%, 5,031. The S&P 500 gained 22 points, 0.1%, 2,075 at the Bell there. For the week gone by, the Dow up 2.5%, the NASDAQ jumped 3%, the S&P 500 advanced 0.2%. Pandora most definitely not hearing the happy music, more like the wah-wah trombones. The company reported a bigger-than-expected loss. The stock disconnected more than 35%. Ouch. Another double-digit fall today. Footwear maker Skechers lost a third of its value after reporting a drop in sales for the last quarter. The company down 31%. We told you about how cloud computing is changing the real estate market. It's also doing wonders for the bottom line of tech companies that do cloud computing. Amazon reported better-than-expected earnings because of its cloud business. The stock clicked up 6.2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.08%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for September. A House Subcommittee on Transportation Security holds a field hearing in Syracuse, New York, on security at the nation's airports. And here's a seasonal tidbit I wouldn't want to squash. October 26th is National Pumpkin Day. National Pumpkin Cheesecake Day? Well, that was earlier this week. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. An update now on the race for the Republican presidential nomination. The candidates have an important date coming up, November the 7th. It's a Saturday, a couple of weeks from now. Donald Trump is going to be hosting Saturday Night Live. Fun will be made, laughs will be had, and federal requirements will be triggered, obliging NBC to give other candidates equal time. Before you unplug the TV at that prospect, though, let Marketplace's Nova Sappho explain the rules, because it's complicated.
When then-Democratic presidential candidate Al Sharpton hosted SNL in 2003, cast member Jimmy Fallon joked about the network having to offer equal time to other candidates.
Gather the whole family around the TV for the Joe Lieberman special, Hanukkah in Connecticut.
What Joe Lieberman actually got was 28 minutes of free airtime on some local NBC stations. There are lots of reasons why. Equal time applies only to broadcast, not cable, only to stations where the show in question aired. And a candidate has to prove a significant presence in the state where the station is located. Meredith McGeehee of the Campaign Legal Center says the broadcast also can't be defined as news.
Where you can kind of draw the line is the difference between a scripted appearance and an interview appearance.
So Donald Trump appearing on Stephen Colbert's show or, say, Entertainment Tonight is exempt. Trump on SNL won't be. And what about Hillary Clinton? She appeared on SNL earlier this month.
I wish you could be president.
Me too.
Lesser-known Democratic candidate Larry Lessig has a pending request for equal airtime.
It's an open and shut case in terms of the right.
Andrew J. Schwartzman is an election law expert and professor at Georgetown Law School. He says Lessig, who claims to have 10,000 supporters who've donated $1 million, will get something. Schwartzman says candidates usually try to negotiate.
For example, if Donald Trump is on for 30 minutes, a candidate may say, well, I'll trade that right for 10 one-minute spots during primetime.
He says that's a common tactic in local markets and could be potentially more valuable than 30 minutes late at night on the weekend. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Molly Wood and I were talking yesterday about valuations in Silicon Valley. Companies in theory worth $1 billion that might not actually be worth $1 billion. While investors try to figure out what's going on there, there is something pretty much everybody in Silicon Valley agrees on, that the tech industry is very white and very male. Companies are trying to do something about it. The latest effort comes from Facebook. Earlier this week, the company launched something that they are calling Tech Prep, a website to introduce kids and their parents to the basics of computer science and computer coding. Sheryl Sandberg is the COO of Facebook, the chief operating officer. Maxine Williams runs diversity for the company. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
We're excited to be here.
Maxine, let me start with you. When we had you on the program, I guess earlier this year, we talked a lot about the pipeline and about how
you and Facebook we're gonna not fix it, but work on it, I guess. Why is this the answer? Why is tech prep the answer?
So this is one of the answers. There are a lot of leaks in this pipeline, Guy, and we're trying our hardest as much as we can to address the things where we feel that we can make an impact. And what we saw with the research we had done and our own experience in investing early on in the potential of underrepresented groups is that once they get the opportunity, the exposure, and the connection to the resources to help them build their skills, they're off and running. So there's no difference in quality. There's a difference in opportunity. We built Tech Prep so that the underrepresented people would have the exposure and they would have the opportunity to gain the skills they needed to take advantage of all of the opportunities in this industry.
Sheryl Sandberg, why is it important that people, girls, young kids, whatever, know how to code? I mean, why do people have to know how their phone works?
When you think about economic growth and you think about potential for individuals to contribute, tech is a great industry. Tech are jobs that are incredibly flexible, have real impact, very highly compensated. We want girls to have the same opportunity to work in the tech industry that boys do, and we're not there. Girls used to be 35% of computer science majors in college, and now women are 18%. So we're going in the wrong direction.
Are you heartened at all, Sheryl, by the recent statistics coming out of, I think it was Stanford, right, that said computer science is the number one choice of entering females for their major?
Yes. Anywhere we see progress, yeah, it's really, really important. There's also been some great work done at Harvey Mudd where they've gotten into the 40% of people in computer science as women. Yeah. It shows it can be done, which is exciting. It also, we know it's going to be hard for other institutions to catch up. We had a summer intern who told me once that there were more Daves than girls in his computer science department at college.
So more people named David than girls?
More people named David than girls in his computer science department, which was not funny and depressing. And so putting women into lean-in circles and helping them have peers, we're already getting the feedback that they feel less alone and they're therefore more likely to continue in the field, graduate, and get a job in tech.
Maxine, when you go out and I don't know, you're at your kid's soccer games or you're standing in line in the supermarket and you chit chat with people and they discover what you do, which is just to refresh people's memory, you're the global head of diversity at Facebook. Do they say, wow, how interesting? Or do they say, yeah, tech, you know, it's white and male and that's a mess?
They say how interesting. And it depends on who the they is. So overwhelmingly, people of color who have not been represented say, how do we do that? What is coding? I have heard the question, what is coding, a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
if you look at Tech Prep on the first page, the main video literally breaks down, spoken by people who look like people who've been underrepresented, what coding is, what computer science is, what it builds. So I get a lot of questions around that. And then besides that, for those who don't know, for those in the Valley, then the questions become more, how are you going to get it, right? There's a lot of competition for this underrepresented talent. And we all have to think about how we raise the level of what's available in the market for the entire industry, right? This is not just about us. It's not about Facebook. We are all better off if there are more talented people who have access to opportunities that we all can access.
Sheryl Sandberg, what is success going to look like? How are you going to know you're doing it right? Because as you know, it's a long lead time with this stuff.
Success is that our companies and our industries and our nonprofits and our government reflect the diversity of the people we serve. And our industry is far from that. Our company is far from that. Every industry and every company are far from that. And we know that if we actually had diverse leaders and more diversity in our company, we would build better products. And I think the more industries and companies understand that diversity is not just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do, the more people will be motivated to get there. You're exactly right that it's a long lead time, and that's why we're investing now. And I think there's a lot more for us and everyone else to do.
Sheryl Sandberg is the COO at Facebook. Maxine Williams is the global head of diversity at that very same company. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us.
This final note on the way out today, in which Well, I don't know. I'm just going to do the piece, and I'm going to let you all decide, all right? The Outpatient Children's Clinic at the University of North Carolina has been renamed. A total of $2 million to support the clinic has been pledged by the Krispy Kreme Challenge. It is, to be clear, a student-run charity based at UNC in support of the clinic, which is great. The challenge, by the way, is to run 2.5 miles, eat a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts, then run another 2.5 miles. So now the clinic will be called the Krispy Kreme Challenge Children's Specialty Clinic. Now, I like a good Krispy Kreme as much as the next guy, only when they're hot, of course, right off that glazing machine. But this, I don't know. Once they cool down, by the way, those Krispy Kremes, forget it. Might as well chuck them. No good at all. All right, the Dow up 157 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ added 111 points, 0.2%. I'm going to get a hate mail from Krispy Kreme lovers, I know it. The S&P 500 gained 22 points, 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. Have a Krispy Kreme. Live a little. All the way. Go ahead. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.